In this episode of the Smart Community Podcast, I have a fantastic conversation with Kim Stirling-Smith, the CEO of Ignite Global. Kim used to call herself a future of work expert, but these days she says that the future of work has arrived, so she has now become a now of work expert. This is another audio from the YouTube series I've been doing, catching up with previous podcast guests and friends of the Smart Community Podcast. In this episode, Kim and I discuss her background and her work and how it's really accelerated in the current crisis. She tells us about her research on what people are learning from this COVID work from home experiment and why we all need to take this disruption seriously, learn from it, and be as prepared as we can be for ongoing disruptions into the future. We explore the relationship between COVID, under and unemployment, and the critical skills shortage, as well as what the workplace will look like post-COVID and what managers in particular have to improve in order to be effective in the workplace of the next decade. Kim tells us about her white paper on the difference between companies that fail, those that survive, and those that thrive after crises and recessions, as well as how she has reset her business during this time. We finish our chat discussing what employees and employers should be thinking about now and the now of work that has arrived. As this video was not a regular episode of the podcast, Kim didn't tell us where to connect with her, but you can find her on LinkedIn or at igniteglobal.com. As always, we hope you enjoy listening to this episode as much as we enjoyed making it.
Welcome to the Smart Community, smart regions, smart towns, and smart cities. It's where we live, work, and play with smart communities. The future starts today. Big data, smart mobility, emerging trends galore. The Smart Community Podcast is what you're looking for.
Hi, Kim. How are you this evening?
I'm good, Zoe. How are you?
I'm very well. I'm really excited to talk to you. I've been watching your stuff on LinkedIn and we've had some conversations. So first of all, let's jump straight in. And can you tell us who you are, what you do,
Absolutely. And
where you are from maybe as well?
Yes, the accent is a bit confusing. So my name is Kim Stirling-Smith. I'm the CEO of Ignite Global. And until March the 13th, 2020, I consider myself a future of work expert, but the future of work arrived at about 5 p.m. on that day when everybody downed tools and started the world's largest work from home experiment. So I now call myself a now of work expert because the future of work has arrived.
Yeah, absolutely. Tell us where you're based.
I was just going to say, yeah, I'm based in Sydney. I have lived in Sydney for about 12 and a half years. Before that, I lived in New Zealand for about 6.5 years, but originally from the US.
Yes, yes. You've still got your accent
there. I do. Can't lose that.
So, we all know what happened. Well, everyone in Australia that's listening knows what happened on the 13th of March. But tell us a little bit more about, you know, how you've gone through, you know, what you did before and how's it different now?
Yeah. You know, honestly, it's not. It's just accelerated. What I teach now is really no different than what I taught before, because I've been trying to help organizations get ready for the future of work for about the last 10 years. I'm a fact finder. I'm an accountant by training, and I like my stats, like my data, like my research. And when I started this business in 2009, I started researching what the workforce was going to be over the next decade or two. And I wanted to leverage the experience that I had had previously working as a recruiter for 15 years. Let me back up a little bit. I actually started this business in 2009 because after 15 years of working as a recruiter and doing 5,000 interviews with people, I like to consider it 5,000 exit interviews, because 5,000 people walked into my office and told me why they wanted to leave their jobs, or more likely their managers. And so I decided that I would leverage that experience and start a consulting firm that I would help organizations create environments where their people could thrive. And I thought that that might be a win-win. So I started doing the research and wanted to increase my knowledge and increase my what I was seeing anecdotally from those 5,000 exit interviews. And I became fascinated with the future of work and fascinated with all of the predictions that the futurists were making, specifically around this decade, because I knew from all of the predictions that we had seen that this decade is really going to be a pivotal decade. And the only difference in what I teach is I expected to really have another couple of years before we were working from home in the numbers that we are now. I was predicting that that would occur between 2022 and 2025 based on the research that I was doing. And of course, it happened literally overnight. I'm doing some fascinating research right now, as a matter of fact. It's out to my 13,000 contacts in my database. So it is global, but primarily centered around New Zealand, asking people what they think the post-COVID workplace is going to look like versus the pre-COVID workplace. And it is unbelievably fascinating to me what people are learning from this work from home experiment. A lot of managers that thought that they were prepared found themselves unprepared. A lot of managers who never thought that a workforce could be productive working from home are being quite pleasantly surprised that they can be. So that's a very long answer to your question, but I'd say that the pace and urgency at which I'm teaching the concepts that I teach has changed, but the concepts certainly have not. I'd venture to say that companies are taking this a little bit more seriously, though, than they did prior to COVID.
No, that's really fascinating. And I'm excited to hear about your research that you've been doing, well, the research you've done, and then the research that you're doing now, because we really need to learn from this time, right? We need to, and the way that you learn is you ask the questions, you measure, you know, the data, you're a data nerd like me, you know, you look at the data and what is it telling us? And I think that's such a key, you know, a really important thing that people like you and I, you know, that analytics, you have to do that during these, you know, these times of crisis, because otherwise we will end up going backwards rather than, you know, that accelerations happen, but we don't really.
Yeah. And, you know, it's really interesting. You've got a really good point there, because we have to learn from this experience. This is not going to be the only disruption that we have in this decade. I'm hoping that it is by far the most, you know, the greatest disruption. I'm hoping that we don't have another global pandemic, although I would not rule that out. I'm hoping that we don't have anything else that makes the world stand still. But it is one of many disruptions, and the disruptions will come in terms of company by company, industry by industry, geography by geography. So we really need to take this seriously now. We need to understand what we need to do as an organization and what we need to do as a people manager to have the right workforce and the right commercial acumen to be able to seize opportunities that come with these disruptions, as well as to overcome challenges.
And that's a really good point, and something that, you know, our business coach Jacqueline Nagel has posted on, and something I've been thinking about a lot is, as much as this is a global pandemic and it's made the world stand still, there are things that happen to people and our businesses that make our world stand still, which produce the same result as, you know, what's happening globally. However, because it's happening to everybody, everyone's aware of it. So you're able to talk about it. We're able to, you know, find these solutions. But when it's just you or just your community or just your business, it's actually even more challenging because it's not happening to everyone else. It's only happening to you.
That is one of the real benefits. And there are a lot of benefits. In fact, there will be winners from this. I was talking to a client today preparing for a virtual training that I'm going to be doing to their client database. So this is a recruitment company who is hosting an event for their clients. And they're asking me to speak on the research that I've done, what employees want post-COVID, what the future of the workplace looks like. And I'll credit her with it, as a matter of fact. Her name is Chloe. And she said, you know, there are going to be some real winners out of this. And I said, I absolutely agree. What do you see? And she said, well, you know, we have completely taken away the excuse that people can't work from home. So that opens up a whole field of people who have been underemployed that can now work to their potential, like the physically challenged, like even the mentally challenged. If you have not been able to go into a workplace and that stopped you from finding work, you might be able to find work now if you set yourself up from home, because we've proven it. We can do it. And that's clearly a benefit to people who have been underemployed. But quite frankly, it's also a huge benefit to employers because, you know, there are some things that will remain true post-COVID that were true pre-COVID that we're not even starting to think about. For instance, the critical skill shortage. You know, here in Australia, we've hit 1 million unemployed people. Now, I'm an ex-accountant and I can't do the math in my head, but that's a lot of people. We're talking about going up to potentially 10%. In the States, they will almost inevitably go up to 20%. That will come back. That will change as the economy gets opened up, and we will get back to a critical skill shortage. At the same time, we're going to have more unemployed people because there's a real disparity in the skills that employers need versus the skills that the people have. So employers can look at a whole different database of candidates and look for those innate abilities or those strengths that are required to be successful in those roles and then provide them training. So one of the opportunities is to bring back some of those unemployed people, but another is to employ the underemployed and use that to help beat this critical skill shortage, because we will be back there within, I'm guessing, a couple of years. We'll be really complaining about the lack of skills available in the marketplace.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's particularly important for regional areas both ways, right? So we're thinking that we can't access skills that we need in regional areas, and so that's a gap. But actually, you can access those skills now. They might just not be right at your front door. So it's been able to shift that mindset that, you know, I have to have somebody sitting here or whatever to actually have that skill set in my and to be able to build trust with that person to perform the job that they need to do.
Absolutely.
And then on the other side, it opens up the opportunity for people living in regional areas if they have those skills, but maybe they're not needed right here in Toowoomba or Roma or Tambo or whatever, but actually maybe they're a data analyst or whatever, but they can actually work for a global company or a council in another jurisdiction that needs that, or maybe they do a bit of both because, hey, that's, and I'm keen to hear your thoughts about how the workforce will shift. I mean, it was already shifting, right? But what are the things we'll see more of now? So actually, yeah, let's go there. What are the things we'll see more of now?
Yeah, well, we'll definitely see more working from home. We're not going back. The research that I'm doing personally is pointing to a blended workplace. There are a few, shall I say, older, primarily male, out there that are answering the survey saying, no, we're going back into offices. We're going back to just the way it was. No, we're not. Sorry to say that. No, I'm not sorry to say that, because we are seeing some really positive things come out of this. The managers who have learned to manage by output versus hours in are finding huge productivity gains. People are finding that they're actually more relaxed working from home. Now, not everybody, not all the time. So what I suspect is that we'll have a blended workplace. And especially as we come out of lockdown and start going back into the office, we're going to have to maintain that physical distancing. I hate the term social distancing because we need the social connection more than ever before, but we're going to have to maintain that physical distancing. So we cannot stack as many people into offices as we have been in the past. So office space has to have more square meterage per person. And I think that we are going to reduce the footprint that we have. A lot of companies are going to utilize downsizing in terms of office space as a cost savings measure as they come into that pre-recovery phase going into recovery. So the workplace is going to be different. I think that we will bring people together for specific meetings to collaborate on projects that have to have some face-to-face interaction. But I think that we will be working from home a lot more. Trust is the currency of the post-COVID world. You hit the nail right on the head. Managers are going to have to learn to trust their employees. And the employees, I have to say, have for the most part, really, really taken the lead in proving how productive they can be. And at the same time, there are, I'm getting reports from the field saying that this work from home experiment has actually shined the torch on some people that were skating by while they were working in the office that probably shouldn't have been. So I think that it's going to be a blended workplace. I also know that organizations are going to have to make some tough commercial decisions. It's going to be a bumpy road. I think the next decade is going to be a bumpy road, not necessarily from even an economic recovery standpoint, but that in addition to the disruptions that we're going to be facing. So businesses are no longer going to have the luxury of good enough is good enough. Good enough is not good enough. It has to be exceptional. Customer service, the quality of your products and services, they have to be exceptional. And the only way to be exceptional is to have an exceptional workforce, which means learning to hire well. Most managers don't know how to hire. 44% of Australian hiring managers were dissatisfied with their last hire on the basis of the last research study that I read out of Hudson Recruitment. So they're going to have to learn to hire. They're also going to have to make very tough commercial decisions, make tough calls, and free up people's future if they're not the people that they need them to be. Managers have to put a priority on managing staff. They no longer can treat managing and leading as an adjunct to their day job. Their role is to inspire and lead staff and to support the people in producing the outcomes that they need for their teams. So we have got a significant portion of managers who should not be in those roles. And they need to either self-select out or they need to be taken out. And in return, we have to provide nonlinear career paths for people. We have to provide alternatives to just being promoted to people manager as a way of getting an additional bump in your pay packet or additional responsibility or additional recognition. We have to recognize people for things other than just managing people. We've got to break free from those shackles of not only pre-COVID thinking, but pre-21st century thinking, because a lot of our processes and practices that we use to hire and manage staff date back to the Industrial Revolution, and quite frankly, have not been updated significantly since then.
And let's hope, you know, the work that we're doing has been updated since then, right?
Yes, definitely.
I'm really keen to hear a little bit more about your, is it a white paper that you produced recently?
Yes. Yes.
So give us the 101.
Well, you know, I have to tip my age, actually, Zoe. I have, look at the look on your face. I have been in the workforce since just after the crash in 87, Black Monday in 87. I graduated from university in 1988. So I came into a pretty poor job market and saw that kind of roller coaster ride. And I went into management consulting. I graduated with a double degree in accounting and computer science. Was terrible in both of those because detail is not my strength. And I very quickly fell into a management consulting role. And then I owned my own business for a while. And then I fell into recruitment, as I said. And I, in the time that I was in recruitment, I also lived through the dot-com boom and then the dot-com bust, 9/11 and the economic fallout from 9/11. And of course, the GFC. I was here in Australia, as a matter of fact. I took a sabbatical in India and I was literally gazing at my navel when the bottom fell out of the economy because I was doing yoga in India and I was completely oblivious to what was going on. Not quite oblivious, but fairly oblivious. And then I got to Australia with the grand intentions of starting a business and the GFC was in full throttle. So I started thinking about this. All of the economic recovery that I have seen, the downturns in recovery. And, you know, it feels like we're all figuring this out together. But if you really take a look at it, and I love the case study of Cisco. If you really take a look at it, the companies, you know, the old adage that more fortunes are made in times of downturn than times of plenty is absolutely true. And I've been looking at this phenomenon for a while, and I started thinking seriously around the time that COVID hit, What makes the difference between companies who don't survive, companies who barely survive, and companies who thrive? And I reckon that it's something that people don't talk about, which is called the pre-recovery phase. I think that most companies, they go through at first security. Oh my gosh, what's happened? Is everybody safe? Is the company safe? Can we get through the next 2 weeks? And then go into survival. And interestingly enough, the research that I'm doing now shows that 70% of Australian companies are in pre-recovery or survival moving to pre-recovery. So we're almost out of that survival phase. That survival phase is, do I have enough working capital? Can I get through the next few months until we start really opening up the economy? And for the most part, I mean, the first economic shock hit the travel industry, the hospitality industry, my events and conference industry really, really hard. The second wave are those companies who don't have enough working capital to make it through survival. But then we go into what we think of as the recovery phase. But I reckon that there's actually almost a secret phase. And I say that it's a secret phase because nobody really, I've not heard anybody talk about it. But I think that it's a phenomenon where it is the phase that companies who know that they can survive, they start stepping back and they say, okay, in order for us to not only survive but thrive through this downturn and come out ahead and start taking market share and start taking good staff from our competitors, what do we need to do? And I think that there are two things that companies need to do. And this is based on not only my experience but also all of the research that I've done. And I'll get to the Cisco case study in a second. Well, in fact, I'll talk about that right now because it's a really good example. In 1987, shortly before Black Monday, the initial CEO of Cisco was let go. And he, I don't know the details of this, but he was let go over a intellectual property violation with Stanford because Stanford incubated Cisco initially. So they let go of their CEO and they went through Black Monday. They lost, they weren't publicly traded yet. They lost a bunch of market value. And in 1987, shortly after Black Monday, they hired a new CEO and they completely changed their business model. They were bought by Sequoia Capital in a private equity firm, and Sequoia Capital worked with them to really put them on firm footing and to look at the products and services and the way they delivered their products and services. And they ended up going IPO. They went public sometime in the 90s, still written about in case studies as the most successful IPO of the 90s, one of the most successful in history. And then the dot-com bust hit. And the 18 months after the dot-com bust, they lost 80% of their market value. And then, of course, 9/11. And they came out stronger than that, stronger from that. They went into the 2008 recession because they are a US-based company. They went into that, lost more market share, came out even stronger. And they've been reorganizing, sort of continuously reorganizing using a continuous improvement model since about 2015. And they're now stronger than ever. As a matter of fact, in November of 2019, they were elected the best company in the world, the Great Places to Work survey, best company in the world to work for. So this is an example of a company that really strategically, right after the downturn and after they've secured their assets and secured their people and have done everything that they needed to do to survive, started thinking strategically about what do we need to do. So what do organizations need to do? I think that they need to do two things. They need to, number one, figure out what the new normal looks like. And this is a guessing game because nobody really knows. The new normal is, and if you look at the graph, and I'm happy to have you post a graph along with this video. If you look at the graph of the waves from disruption to recovery, the new normal is kind of a fickle beast initially because she'll look like one thing and then she'll turn around and look like another. And it takes months or even years sometimes for the new normal to really settle, the new way of doing things to really settle. So organizations need to bet on what they think the new normal is, and then, if they're proven wrong, be able to pivot really quickly. So that's number one, is really tracking that new normal and figuring out what it's going to look like and leaning into that new normal and then pivoting if it proves to be wrong. Number two is taking a really hard look at themselves and what was exposed after the shock of COVID, what cracks were exposed in the organizational structure, in the communication structure, in the financial structure, in their business continuity plans, their crisis recovery plans, in their management, in their staff, everything. So there are 19 different points, actually, that I go through in the white paper from a commercial perspective as well as a workforce perspective. And they need to really cement those cracks. So between the two of those, tracking and pivoting with a new normal and cementing the cracks of what's gone wrong, they can set themselves up to actually thrive post the recovery instead of just surviving and not be caught out in that third wave of companies that will inevitably fall over. After the initial shock and after those without working capital end up falling over, there will be a third wave, which are those companies that get caught out by their competitors who start taking market share and good staff because they haven't recovered. They haven't prepared appropriately during pre-recovery.
So interesting. And I'll be honest, I haven't read the full paper yet. So that's
next. It's a long paper.
But we can definitely post a link when we put this up as well. But no, thanks so much. That, I mean, you've been able to summarize that really well, and obviously you wrote it. So, you know, this is your IP and your thinking, and yeah, just to be able to summarize it like that, it all made sense to me. So thanks so much for sharing.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I'm really keen to hear, like, for you in your business, you know, you've stopped your face-to-face like I have, you know, lots of events being cancelled. Are you going online? How's that working for you? How have you had to do things differently? Tell us a little bit about that.
It's been phenomenal. It's been the reset that I've needed for a number of different reasons. The last, you know, everybody, well, hopefully everybody sort of levels up in their thinking and in the services that they've been able to provide. And this has allowed me to stop and take stock of who I really want to be to the marketplace, what value I really want to add. So I am in the process. In fact, I spent all day long today mapping out my two signature programs. One's called the Spot On Hiring System, and the other's called Mind Reading for Managers. And I've been teaching both of those programs. Well, Spot On Hiring, I've been teaching since I was a recruiter, teaching managers how to hire better people. And so that's going on probably 20 years that I've been teaching that. And Mind Reading for Managers, I developed as a result of a client asking me to replace their performance management system, or actually to come up with something that wasn't a performance management system because they had gotten large enough that they needed to implement something and they didn't want to do what was not working, what doesn't work is that old once a year performance management. So I came up with a series of one-on-one conversations that happened on a monthly basis. So I'm in the process of putting those online, and that's going to enable me to really free up my time. I think that it's going to be, and hopefully the way I'm designing it, it's going to be a superior delivery methodology because they won't be so reliant on me. They'll be able to go back and review the videos and go back and review the assets. And I plan on structuring it so it takes them through step by step what to do. So I think it's going to be a superior delivery model. It's also going to free up my time so that I can spend more time doing the high level consulting, doing the thought leadership and the strategy. And I am working on, well, I've got an overarching model called the Unified Theory of Everything People. Mm-hmm. Which debuted at the Atlassian Summit, which turned into a remote summit. I was supposed to fly to Las Vegas in April, but that didn't happen. Mm-hmm. And I debuted that in April at the Atlassian Remote Summit. So I plan on speaking about that, the holistic new paradigm model for building and retaining exceptional people. Mm-hmm. And I'm also doing a lot of work with the C-suite on the now of work, what that looks like from both a commercial perspective as well as a workforce perspective, and really helping them understand what strategy they need to take and look at in terms of not only workforce management, but the other commercial considerations. How do you secure your customers? What do you even offer in this new world? So I'm going to be doing more of that. And then I'm actually going to be working on a new idea that I've been bubbling around in my mind. And that is, and you're actually the first to hear about this. Well, I lie. You're not the first. You're the second. Jacqueline's the first. I talked to her about it on Monday. You know, growing up in the United States, I was fed a steady diet of American exceptionalism. And you only have to look at the results of Australia and New Zealand compared to the United States. And what COVID has done is it's really shined the torch on some of the huge problems in the U.S. in terms of healthcare, in terms of income disparity, in terms of racism. There are a number of issues. And it's, I think, to me, it's really calling into question something that I grew up taking for granted, which is American exceptionalism. And I started thinking about what exceptionalism actually is, and comparing and contrasting the idea of exceptionalism, which might be just smoke and mirrors and a good marketing plan, and what exceptionalism really means. So that's my next research project, and something that you'll hear me talk a lot more about in the next 6 months or so.
That's so exciting. Thanks so much for sharing it with us here. And yeah, I'm really looking forward to that. And I mean, I'm always watching, your feed on LinkedIn. I'm really enjoying this now of work. And I love that because it, I mean, maybe I can argue, but let's see. I would argue that the now of work has been here for quite a long time. It just depends who took it and ran with it. And we'll see those businesses and companies, they were successful. People liked working there. It just took a long time, or, you know, it will take a long time to kind of weed out or shift, because, you know, change takes a long time, but to shift so then this status quo isn't the normal anymore, but this is, and then we start, like, that's the now. If that didn't make any sense at all, or did it?
No, I understand what you're saying. The now of work has been the now of work. It hasn't been the future of work for a lot of companies. And certainly employees have been demanding some of these things. And some of the employers, well, a lot of the employers were really hesitant to meet those demands, the flexibility, the ability to work from home, the ability to collaborate, the ability to understand what's going on behind the scenes from a financial perspective with their organizations, trusting in the organizations, having the organizations and the managers trust in them. This has really been driven by the workforce. It's been driven primarily by millennials and by women coming into the workforce. And adoption, I think is the right word, of it has really accelerated because of COVID. And that's a good thing. I mean, there, you know, I do not take lightly the number of businesses and the number of people that are suffering. And at the same time, there's, I think, going to be some tremendous, tremendous gains from this. And my hope is that the people who are suffering are not suffering for long. And I'm really, really pleased and proud of the way our government has handled it. I don't necessarily weigh into Australian politics because, quite frankly, I don't know that much about it. Know far much more about U.S. politics, having been raised on U.S. politics since I was, you know, knee high to my father, who was a history major. I've been really impressed with the leadership of this country and how they have really put a line in the sand and taken care of the Australian people. So I'm hoping that our road to recovery will be short rather than long. And I'm hoping that after we see things like Job Seeker and Job Keeper and a number of the short-term stopgap measures, I'm hoping that there's more money put aside towards retraining, because there's going to be a lot of the workforce that needs retraining. I'm also hoping that the government and organizations and educational institutions take resilience seriously, because we have got to be resilient. We have got to be adaptable and open to change. If we're not, we're not going to make it through this next decade. We're just not. So we really need to make sure that we come up to the level that we need to be in those areas as well.
Yeah, it's going to be a really interesting time moving forward. And I mean, I use the word interesting quite a lot, but it's because I'm so curious that I find so many things interesting. But yeah, I think moving forward, what that will look like and how we are looking after, you know, the people with the most at stake if we don't get this right will really hopefully set us apart from what's happening around the world and make our recovery shorter. I'm not sure. It'll be interesting and be following along.
I think we have a real opportunity. I think that we have an opportunity, not that, you know, Australia has been, we're reliant on the US, but far less so than we were when I moved to this part of the world 18 years ago, which is a good thing. And I think that we have an opportunity, especially now that they're talking about opening up the border between Australia and New Zealand. You know, we've got an opportunity to align ourselves with other countries and to, I think that this is going to have enormous ramifications from a geopolitical standpoint. And that is not my area of expertise, but like you, I find that very interesting, extremely interesting, what's going to happen as a result of that. And being the eternal optimist, I am hoping for the better. I'm also hoping that we can do what we've done as a planet in coming together to solve some of the issues, you know, the next really pressing issues like climate change. I mean, if we can come together to stop a virus in its tracks like we have in this part of the world, and, you know, companies can innovate, changing their business model and designing and fitting out their factories to make ventilators and to make masks and PPE, you know, hopefully we can come together and solve that next really major problem that we're facing down the barrel of.
Mm-hmm. It's been so great to chat with you, Kim. I feel like we could keep talking for a couple of hours.
I do, Zoe, yes.
And I look forward to our next conversation as well, because I know that won't be too far away. I don't want to wrap up, but I'm going to have to. Leave us with a couple of your, I guess, your not key tips, but more just like, what are the things that we should be thinking about now if we are thinking about the now of work? Maybe if we are sitting at home, this is the first time we've ever worked from home, and not tips about working from home necessarily, but from what should we kind of expect now that we are in the now of work?
Yeah, I'll answer that from two standpoints. First of all, from as an employee, we need to absolutely take responsibility for our career. So we have to look out towards the future. We have to start to gauge that new normal. What's the new normal going to look like? How is that going to impact what we do and our career? And we need to be responsible for getting the appropriate training, even if we have to pay for it to do that. The other thing that we need to do is we need to start talking in terms of outputs or outcomes versus hours in. So talk to our managers about what we're achieving. Talk to our managers about how we can help, how we can be a resource, how we can be value add, and really take responsibility for that. From a management standpoint, it's how do we build that currency of trust? How do we empower our people so that they are able to perform at their best, to give them the autonomy to use the very strengths that we hopefully hired them for to achieve the outcomes, those objectives? So first of all, we need to make sure that they have outcome-based objectives with measurable results. It'll make it a heck of a lot easier for you to manage them, and it will also give them clarity and certainty around what they're expected to achieve and how success is measured. And then don't lose that humanistic side of things. I have had so many managers come to me with success stories talking about how rich their conversations have been with their employees, because they're stopping to ask how they are and they're actually interested and they're learning about them as a people and as a person, and they're bonding, they're coming together as a community. So don't lose that human element from that. And for both sides of the equation, employees and employers, resilience and the ability to embrace change. So that's what I'd like to leave you with, Zoe.
Thanks so much. We'll finish it there because that was just perfect to leave us with. So thank you again, Kim, for coming on to this version of the podcast. And yeah, I really look forward to our next conversation.
Thank you. So do I, Zoe. Take care.
Talk soon. Bye.
Bye.
The The Smart Community Podcast is brought to you by My Smart Community. If you're looking for support in podcast strategy and production, workshop design and facilitation, or communication and media advisory, get in touch. Email hello@mysmart.community or head to www.mysmart.community.
Thanks so much for listening to the Smart Community Podcast. Show notes for this episode and all other episodes are available on our website, mysmart.community/podcast. If you have any questions for us or any of our guests, you can email hello@mysmart.community. You can also find us on the socials. We are on LinkedIn and Twitter @smartcomhq. That's com with two M's. If you are enjoying the podcast, please hit subscribe so you never miss an episode. And we would love for you to leave us a rating and review at wherever you listen. This really helps us reach more ears and eyes, so thank you for your support. As always, we hope you enjoyed listening to this episode as much as we enjoyed making it.
The Smart Community Podcast is what you're looking for.